Well, after a short break, we've been rejoined by Gil Johnson, who is a longtime member of our blind community. And we want to pick up the story now. In 1978, middle of the Carter administration, you just got a bright and shiny new job, and it's the first time you're going to be working in a position of responsibility with the Lighthouse as it existed in 1978. So why don't you paint a picture of what the Lighthouse was then?
Well, it was an organization in transition. The director, Jim K. Wood, who recruited and hired me, came from a non-blindness background. He was an insurance executive back east. I don't know what brought him out here. I don't know how he learned about the job or got it, but he was one of a very important mentor in my life. He understood people really well, and he understood organizations, and he understood leadership. His saying always was that the job of the executive director was to be enough in front of the pack to create a vacuum so that others could fill it. And he did his darndest to do that. And not in a, you know, presumptuous or overdriving era, but way, but really just a way to create space so that if we could find the funding and felt there was a need and could do the staffing to create programs that didn't exist. So when I joined the Lighthouse, actually it was in 1977, it took me a while to figure things out, but it was a very fragmented organization. There was Blindcraft, which was the sheltered workshop, which was at 1097 Howard Street, manufactured brooms, red planter boxes made out of redwood, some subcontract work. And there were people that had been there for years and years. And it was a pretty closed group of people, about 30-some, 35 maybe. There was the Education Recreation Program, which was housed in the facility at 745 Buchanan Street, just off Hayes, in its very own building. And a lot of social activities there. They served a hot meal every day that was prepared on site. Teachers were there from the, I don't know if it was adult education or community college district, I'm not sure which, and offered a variety of of classes, Braille being one, daily living skills, and frankly, I never did know really that much about what went into them. All I know is that they had clients that were in the same class for years and years and years.
And who was the director there?
His name was Kermit Sheets. I don't know where he came from. He was there when I started, and he was a very nice gentleman. Knew nothing about blindness, or what he knew about it, he had learned, you know, on the job. Good person. But the services there and the clients there were pretty much unto themselves, and there was virtually no interface between them and the sheltered workshop program.
Would it be fair to characterize it as something you see in many American cities, a day program for adults who sort of come in the morning and spend the whole day kind of in a sort of way an adult daycare kind of operation?
Yes, or more like a senior center. And, you know, it could be called adult daycare, I guess. But it was a place where people came, and that's where they spent their day. Transportation was made available. Like I say, hot lunch was served every day. Later on, I can talk about that a little later, we tried to develop program connections with seniors centers throughout the city to try to get clients interested in going to a community senior center near their home rather than coming wherever they came from to the more segregated blind center. I can talk a little bit about that later.
Okay.
So there was that. There was, of course, Enchanted Hills Camp, and Orjean May was the director there. She was hired, I think, in 1975 or 76. Her son, Mike May, is one that's well known to the Lighthouse, of course, and he spent a lot of time there as a child, I think, as a camper, but a very active one. And again, not a lot of connection between that program and the others. Probably some of the people from the senior center did go to the adult sessions at camp during the summer, but that was their only connection. And then there was the deafblind program, and that mostly served the workshop had six or seven deafblind clients that worked there, and a man by the name of Bob Miller, who was deaf, was basically the program, the program manager. He spent much of his time working with the deafblind clients there in the workshop, and on the evenings and on the weekends. I mean, that was his life. And once a month, there was a monthly deafblind party that was held, usually at the Lions Blind Center in the East Bay. And so the clients from the workshop and then deafblind persons from the community would gather there, and Bob would recruit interpreters to be there, and it was a social. Very little interaction with virtually no interaction with the Buchanan Street Center. There was at camp, was then and still is now, a deafblind session, and that would, most of the people in the deafblind club, so it was kind of called that, would go there along with others from the community who were deafblind. That would be usually a 5-day or 6-day session at camp. So there was those pieces, and then there was also newly added, I think in about before I came, the low vision services, which were provided through what was then called Pacific Medical Center over on Webster Street. And an ophthalmologist by the name of Gus Cullenbrander was the doc there, and there was a coordinator, and I think the Lighthouse, I think we put up something like $15,000 a year to help fund that program.
And that was at Pacific Med Center on Van Ness?
No, on Webster.
On Webster, okay.
Yeah. It's where now where the Well, at that time, it was a Presbyterian Medical Center. Now it's the Pacific Medical Center. But same program. Again, very little connection between any of the other programs that the Lighthouse offered. So it was really scattered. We started to have, I guess, what could be called executive meetings with Jim K. Woods, the director of development and communications, a man by the name of Jack Sorries, myself, the accountant that we had at that time, and then the workshop director, Art McComber, the director at the Buchanan Street, Kermit Sheets, and O.J. May. So there'd be the seven of us.
And I'm just reflecting that of the seven directors of all the units, you're the only blind one?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. And talked about a number of things. We would have, sometimes we'd have retreats up at camp, sometimes over at a meeting facility at UC Berkeley. We would have a retreat there. Trying to think through what is it that we wanted, where did we want the Lighthouse to go? How could it go there? How could it get, you know, what funding would it need? What need is there that it would meet? And we began, that was kind of the beginning of the attempts to pull things a little bit more together. Because up until that time, the program directors, the workshop and Buchanan Street primarily, had virtually no connection with each other. So we thought about that. Jim K. Wood pretty much, though, turned to me and wanted me to design what would be the next step to take to provide better services, more comprehensive services, and as a way of pulling these entities together. And our first step in that direction was to hire an orientation mobility instructor. And we did that and began then to chip away at the separation, because the mobility instructor, of course, he could go wherever he was needed. And so there were people at the center, as we called it, Buchanan Street, who wanted some additional mobility instruction, and so they got that. And some of the folks in the workshop, similar.
And let me just interrupt here and set a little context. I mean, here you are, you're starting this new job, you're around 40, and I remember from our earlier conversations that even going around San Francisco yourself as a student, and then a little bit later, you were not yourself using a white cane in those days.
Oh, yes, I was.
You were then.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I got out of high school, I mean, when I was in high school, I didn't, because, I knew the campus so well, and I knew the city really well, and it was small. But when I got out, then, well, around my home area, I didn't so much. But when I went to Denver, or when I went to, and then when I went to the university, sure, I was carrying a white cane. It was usually a folding one or a telescopic one. But yes, I always use a cane.
And at the Buchanan Street or in the factory, how many people were using white canes when you got there? And what was, and why did you decide that was the first thing you had to do?
I don't know how many were actually using them, and if they were, they certainly weren't using them in a very good way. At least I didn't think so. They had been helped to get places for so many years that they didn't feel like they needed to very much. Some did. Clearly they did, but mostly they did not. And we also wanted to be able to reach out into the community and begin to engage the Department of Rehabilitation clients that they might have, that they would pay for, too. And that's why we decided to get a trained O&M instructor. And so I don't know what portion of the client load that the O&M instructor had that was from the community and what from within. My hunch is that most of what he did was because of referrals from the Department of Rehab for people in the community. But it began to build, though, and people began to realize, that they could learn to do more than they thought they could. We then realized that there was just a lot of people that were particularly newly blinded people that weren't getting, didn't have access to counseling services to help adjust to recent loss of vision. And one of the people that was also considered for the position that I was hired for, and Kaywood chose me, was probably one of the best social workers that I've ever worked with, a lady by the name of Donna Emerson. And I was able to talk her into coming on board as both as a therapist, and she was one of the best, and as one then who would begin to build our counseling services program. And we hired another therapist under her direction and began to build that. Kaywood had the idea, and it was at the time pretty revolutionary, I would say, that much of what was done or not done in the blindness system was because people that were serving blind clients, and many of them were well-meaning and good people, weren't working together with their colleagues, from different disciplines. And his idea was to create an environment and a program where there was people were working together as a team. And as we built it, there was, of course, myself and then Donna as the therapist, and we added another piece that we added was an information referral service program, and we hired a very good person to head that up. The O&M instructor was part of it, and as we began to build then this program, we began to forge a team. And so if there was a client that anyone was working with, there would be team meetings to discuss how we best could help that person. And the team leader might be the therapist, or it might be the O&M instructor, or it might be the INR specialist, might be the deafblind specialist. But the idea was that everyone in the lighthouse who could contribute to that person's program would do so as part of the team. That was a concept that was quite new, and it took a lot of work, and it took a lot of training. Donna was probably better equipped to help pull that together than I was, because coming from rehab never worked as a team. All the rehab counselors were very, and they still are, you know, it's a one-man show.
Right.
They don't work as a team. And so that was my background. But it made a lot of sense to me. And why Kaywood would come up with this vision of a team-centered program, I have no idea. But he understood it, and he supported it wholeheartedly. And over a period of a couple of years, we developed quite a good team atmosphere. And people got their egos out of the way. And when we would staff a client, you know, it was really discussing who could best serve that person, in what way, and what kind of support did they need.
Mm-hmm. Now, just across the bay in Berkeley, also for adults, was the Orientation Center for the Blind. Why would somebody go to the Lighthouse and not go to OCB in the 1970s?
They might do both. We were not ever a substitute for OCB, you know, because we didn't have a residential program. We didn't have, you know, the cooking and ADL classes that they had, that OCB has. We did have Braille instruction, and we did have mobility. But that was, it wasn't an either or kind of thing as far as we were concerned. And like I say, there would be people that would come through OCB, and then when they came into the community, you know, if we were asked, we would help them learn more about the community and traveling about in the community and so forth than OCB did. So it wasn't a competition at all. So that went on. The reason that the Lighthouse was able to expand in the way it was because of a bequest from a family called Zimmerman's. It was the Zimmerman program, and it was a bequest of $1 million, and that was to go for children's services. And Kaywood was clever enough to walk that line between, you know, providing services to adults while at the same time building the children's services program. So I know that a good part of my salary as the program director came from the Zimmerman money, because from early on I was focused on trying to decide what did the Lighthouse really want to offer to, quote, children or their families, in addition to, you know, what they got up at camp. And that was, you know, camp was fine, but that was just, you know, 8 or 10 weeks during the summer, and then nothing during the year.
Right.
So I think it was about 1980 when we formally, we'd hired a consultant to kind of do a needs assessment, I guess you would we would call it now. Phil Hadland was the person that did that. And he was very familiar with the Blind Babies Foundation and what they do and with what the schools does. And he pulled together kind of a study and presented it to staff and to the board. And from that, we decided that what we would do is expand the social services program to provide counseling and intervention services, advocacy services for children and their families, using clinicians and therapists, as opposed to hiring one of the candidates that we might have hired but chose not to, was a person with a background in education. And so we did not take the route of trying to expand by providing educational services for blind kids. It was more of the clinical approach. But it fitted in well with the other programs we were putting together. And so the children's services staff, as we began to build that, fitted in quite well with the rest of the staff that we had.
And by children, Blind Babies Foundation was already well established then. So did this pick up where Blind Babies left off then?
Yes, yes. Yeah, we were definitely not going to, I mean, unless there was a really outstanding need for, some clinical services for families of young blind children. We left that work to the Blind Babies Foundation, mm-hmm. because they were so well established, so well known, and at that time reasonably well funded, and we didn't see that we should even try to duplicate what they did. But we wanted, as you say, we wanted to pick up where they left off.
So I'd love you to paint us a picture, because it is hard to do a children's program today in 2017. When did you do it? After school? Getting kids to show up at the Lighthouse with families who have multiple commitments and traffic and all that today is an exceptionally hard task. So can you paint us a picture of who came? What did they do? How long did they stay? Was it a weekend? Was it after school during the week? Tell us about the children's program.
It was really more working with people in their home environment. Some at the agency, but at that time we really didn't have the facilities that would attract families, let alone children, to come. Certainly not at Howard Street. That was not, there might be a gathering there of parents, but on a Saturday, let's say. But that was not a place where kids could come and run around and have a good time and learn stuff. And so much of the work then was done in their homes. And again, the idea of the team support was in conjunction with the school they were in, or with if Blind Babies Foundation was still involved and working with them, and our staff would provide the clinical support and intervention and advocacy and training. As I say, usually in the community, we did have some sessions up at camp that were more focused on families. And we ran several sessions in partnership with the Blind Babies Foundation, and had our clinical staff up there, for a long weekend. But that was probably the greatest use of the Lighthouse facility with the children's program. There would be as the counseling program developed, and once we moved into 1155 Mission, we did have soundproof counseling rooms, and that would be used sometimes with family members, who could come in, usually late afternoon, evenings, sometimes on the weekend. But like I say, mostly it was really focused on working with them in their home and in the community.
Okay.
So the one I didn't mention was that I think it would have been around 1979, we got a grant from the Helen Keller National Center to hire a deafblind specialist. And we did that, and that person, of course, worked with the clients in the workshop, and with the deafblind, the monthly deafblind party, they would be involved. That person would be involved with them as well, but it was really reaching out more to other deafblind people that we knew were in the community. And at that time, there were a couple of really leading persons who were deafblind in the community. A lady by the name of Dolores Follett, bright, bright, sharp lady, totally deaf, totally blind, had reasonably good speech. I think I don't know when she lost her hearing exactly, but and of course she was became a real kingpin at the deafblind camp sessions. I saw her hold a whole room full of people as she would tell slightly off-color stories. She was an amazing lady. But so we then of course we developed a very strong relationship with the Helen Keller National Center. I went back to the National Center for a week of training, to improve my knowledge and skills of working with deafblind folks, so I could better support the deafblind specialist that we had. And I think that program ran for. That funding ran for probably 4 or 5 years, until probably about the mid-80s, when things began to kind of come unglued.
So the coming unglued is a chapter I want to explore in a minute, right. But you painted a good picture of the lighthouse as you found it and then as you started to improve it. But I wanted to pause and talk about you a little bit, because somewhere along the line, you did acquire a wife, and I wondered if you could tell us the story of how you met Becky and how that developed and what that meant to you.
Well, my wife, I guess, spotted me before I knew about her. We were both students at San Francisco State. She had grown up in Oregon and had her... she had her bachelor's degree and I think was working on her master's in education, and came to San Francisco State because she wanted a degree in special education teaching. And a lot of us would hang out around the education building because there was a study room that if we wanted to, we could go in there and study and work with readers and so forth. So it was kind of a place where folks with visual impairments or people that were in education of the visually impaired would come and hang out. So she and I met in that room and, got to know each other a bit and started dating. This would have been in the probably 59 or 60. And, we developed a friendship and then started going out more and more together. And then she she up and took a job in Reno, a teaching job. And so then if I wanted to see her, I'd have to go to Reno, or, you know, she'd come here and we'd, you know, spend the weekends together. And so things developed as they do. And so in 1962, we got married. And the story I tell is that she and I were probably one of the few people that got married and then 6 months later started living together, because she was teaching in Reno and I was here. I was a student at San Francisco State. So we got together as often as bus fare would allow. But then she finished her second year of teaching in Reno and moved back down here and then got a job teaching in Castro Valley. And so then we moved to the East Bay and rented a house and started a family. And it was around that time that I got my first professional job as a rehabilitation counselor with the Department of Rehab.
So those were very different times for blind people, and not so many blind people were supporting even themselves, let alone a family. I wonder if I might ask you to address this big question that was probably in a lot of blind young men's and women's minds back then, which was, could I do it myself? Could I make a go of this? Would I be always somebody else's dependent? You might want to tell a story of earlier in your life and that issue of dependency, and then how you felt by the time you were ready to propose and tie the knot.
Well, my parents, they never had a doubt that I was going to go to work. That was never a doubt in their mind. Now, my mother thought that I would be a teacher, because she knew blind folks could teach. So she thought that's what I should do. As a matter of fact, when I got the first few jobs I had, she didn't seem to understand that I wasn't a teacher, that I was a counselor. But that, you know, that's not that important. What I remember, though, was being at a gathering of our family. My oldest brother died in there was an explosion in the J.C. Penney store he was working in Wisconsin, and after 7 or 8 days, he died. And there was a gathering of the family, aunts and uncles and cousins and so forth. And I was there, and of course my mother was distraught, and so was my father. I didn't know my older brother as well. I mean, I knew what was going on, but I wasn't as devastated as they were. But I remember sitting there, and I heard one of my aunts, I think, say to my mother, "Well, you know, we really, you've had so many burdens in your life, you know, Leroy and being killed, and then you've had Gilbert all his life as a burden." And I just remember either wanting to go over and slap that person or walk out of the room. I was insulted, because I never thought of myself as being a burden or wanting to be a burden to anyone. And something inside of me changed at hearing that. And I really decided that it just added to my desire that, yes, I was going to make it. I didn't know how, but I was going to. And I was not going to be, you know, dependent on other people for my support.